Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is working to bring diverse audiences together in Tulsa through art. Rico Wright is the director of the nonprofit Black Wall Street Arts and its gallery arm, the Black Wall Street Gallery, located in the historic Greenwood District. Wright is a native Tulsan who returned to the city from New York City, where he received his doctorate from Columbia in mathematics. His plan was to give back, teaching at his alma mater, Langston University. But budget cuts saw teaching cutbacks, and Wright turned to a new idea, exploring ways to bring Tulsans together through art in the same way he had experienced in New York City. The inaugural project at the Black Wall Street Gallery is something he calls the Conciliation Series, a series of month-long exhibitions pairing two local artists, one white and one black, to show their art, but also to spark conversation and dialogue about our city's racial and socioeconomic relationship. Rico Wright joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Rico, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I have to ask a question. How does a Columbia-trained mathematician end up running an art gallery here back in your hometown of Tulsa?
That's an excellent question. While in graduate school, I attended a lot of arts events through the Columbia University Arts Initiative. I was very excited about this initiative because it gave us free or reduced tickets to everything in the city. I mean, everything imaginable. Carnegie Hall, the Metropolitan Opera House, the Met Museum. So I just fully immersed myself in the arts culture, given that, I mean, it was practically free most of the time, you know. And I saw a particular exposure to life that I wanted to share with other people. Having seen that exposure, I realized, like, wow, this is important for personal growth and development, right?
Now, was that something you did when you were growing up here in Tulsa?
No, I think that's the point. It's because I didn't get to do that, right? Uh-huh, right? It was more the lack of exposure. Not to say that those things weren't available. I would just say that they weren't as valued in my household. Music was, but the performing arts in a strict sense, no. Maybe enjoying them on the television, but I wouldn't
even say.
Visual
arts, maybe.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say that we had the wherewithal to actually explore in that way, right?
Right,
I mean, when museums and galleries are free, maybe. But not when they come at an expense. You know, we're just trying to make sure we get the bills paid and get groceries in the pantry.
You know? So how did that change you, having all that exposure all of a sudden when you were in New York City?
Yeah, it was transformative. I would definitely say that in the beginning it was an overstimulant, right? Like, I'd have to go home and decompress, like, day after day because it was so overwhelming in a good way. But transformative insofar as, like, I saw how my world was being reshaped through the arts, because I find that the arts is inviting, right? It was allowing me to examine myself, to examine society, examine, you know, artists themselves and thinking about how they express themselves. It inspired me to find an outlet to express myself, even though I'm not a visual artist, right? I'm a philosopher, poet. And so you mentioned mathematics. We can get to how I even transitioned from one to these other two. But yeah, it was through the arts that I sort of saw a place for me to express myself.
Yeah. Now, you were in New York City for a number of years.
Yeah, 10 years.
10 years. Did you sort of totally become immersed in the arts? You mentioned philosophy, poetry, and
yeah.
the like.
So what happened there? I was in the mathematics program, and I was interested in learning more about other fields, psychology and philosophy. And became friends with some philosophy majors who invited me to a reading group. It was a Plato reading group, and I hadn't read a lot of philosophy. It was more on the peripheral, you know, just learning about this person, that person, but not really reading a text for what it was. And it was through these discussions with these philosophy majors where they would say, like, wow, you're really thinking philosophically, that I was encouraged to, like, you know, even give a commentary on a particular thought or idea. And from there, I started seeing the sort of intersection of mathematics and philosophy, which was logic. And I enjoy logic a great deal. And then from there, I started seeing that these philosophers were thinking of things that in yesteryear I sort of thought about. I mean, not as deeply at the time, right? But I had some thought about this or that, morality, justice, and so on. And it just fit really well. And then, of course, you learn later that back in the day, you had you know, these Renaissance men and women who...
What was used to be referred to as amateurs.
Yeah.
And amateurs is, you know, it's not, doesn't mean you're mediocre. It means you just explored all sorts of things.
Right, right.
And yeah, it meant that you were a gentleman usually.
Yeah.
And you had this time to basically explore all of these avenues.
That's right. And many of my favorite philosophers are or were both mathematicians and philosophers, right? You have Plato, okay. Immanuel Kant, you have Wittgenstein, right? So I started seeing that I had a space to fill. You know, I could fit in this group even though my background was mathematics.
You talked about the performing arts. You talked about the verbal arts, you know, rhetoric and letters. Where did visual art come into it?
Well, I think for me, it was more an appreciation for it. And I also was thinking in terms of affecting change. It's another way that we can do so. And it's one where the viewer is situated in a context where, you know, it's an individual experience. So one is observing this painting, and there's some experience happening. And there's some intentionality on the part of the painter, right? But knowing that that's taking place is empowering. It's empowering for me because I know that we can actually continue to push certain agendas through visual arts. So if there's a point that we need to get across, well, painters can do that, and then viewers can experience that in a way that's not so abrasive, right? I mean, sometimes
art is abrasive.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know. But I think in the main, it's not, right? It's more the individual interpreting what that is and then concluding something based on that.
Right. Now, you spent about 10 years in New York. It sounds like you were immersed in both your professional field as well as this new emerging sort of interest in art, philosophy, and literature. What brought you back home to Tulsa?
Okay, so here we are again talking about philosophy, right? I recall reading a Socratic dialogue where Socrates is talking about mortal beings acquiring immortality, right? And I'm thinking, how can that happen? And so he lays out a few examples. You know, one could have children and the children carry on the name. One could do some great work, be it writing a book or releasing an album. You know, you'll become, you know, a sort of mortal being, but immortalized through that work. Or you could leave a legacy. And I was thinking, wow, like I would like for my life to be meaningful anyway. But going back home was that thing, you know, staying in Harlem, for example, and making a difference in that community. It would be a good thing, but it's not my community necessarily. Right. I didn't grow up there. I'm not a product of the environment, whereas Tulsa is my home and I am a product of this environment. And so I saw that coming back and giving back would be a meaningful thing.
Struck by something in your doctoral exit interview that Columbia does, in which you talked about Dr. Ernest Holloway.
That's right.
President of Langston, the first homecoming when your mother came to visit you at college. And, and he, you know, he said, we are expecting great things. And it was he said, you know, it was, I think.
He called me a rising star.
A rising star, said, yeah. And yeah. You said, it was not that he hoped. He was saying, I expect.
That's right.
And so when people ask me about him, I will say, I know this happened.
Yeah.
That has to be an empowering statement that has to have an effect on this.
Yeah. And I would say, I mean, not that I had bad teachers throughout, but I would definitely say that the vast majority of them did not have high expectations of me, right? And that could have been part and parcel due to my behavior in the classroom, right? I definitely talked out of turn quite a bit and got in trouble for it. But yeah, I think that high expectation from someone of such high caliber, just it meant the world to me, you know. And I noticed over time that many people felt strongly about Dr. Holloway in this way. He really had a lot of faith in his students, whom he called his children, you know.
So was it sort of that situation?
Yeah, he in a way became a mentor of mine, and he would go on trips to, you know, different cities to meet with dignitaries and such, and he would bring along student leaders with him. And I had gotten to go on a few trips, and I was exposed. I remember the first time I got on an airplane was to take a trip to Seattle with the SGA president and Dr. Holloway. I mean, I was afraid to fly, you know, because this was my first time. I'm listening to my mom's echo in my ear. She never flew, you know. And so I was thinking, like, wow, this is great for me to experience life. Again, going back to that exposure. But Dr. Holloway never hesitated to take students on trips and to put them in leadership positions and to challenge them, you know, to reach their potential.
So you came home to give back.
And here I am.
Yeah. So Langston, you came back and taught at Langston. They experienced some severe budget cuts.
That's right.
You were the newest faculty.
Yeah.
So you're no longer faculty
there. Yeah, last in, first out.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the policy.
So you were looking for a new way to get back. And so you came upon this idea of the Black Wall Street street arts.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about this.
So when I had come back, I was thinking about just understanding the landscape, right? So I took some time just, you know, to meet some people and get a lay of the land before venturing out, because I wanted to make sure that whatever I did was filling a gap, you know. And this past summer, I used to host soirees at my home, much like Gertrude Stein did back in Paris, you know, with Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway. But yeah, I thought, you know, if I could work toward bringing the arts community together and we can start building unity amongst ourselves, that it could be a good thing, right? And so these soirees were awesome because I got to see many different artists, right? You had writers, you had poets, you had painters, musicians. They'd all come. At one point, there were 250 people.
You wow. know,
it was like a house party, really. But it was at that point that I realized, like, wow, like the arts can really be a difference maker.
And this is starting to happen in our community, which I think from the time you left to the time you came back, perhaps you're seeing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's vastly different.
I mean, when you left, I'm sure there was this huge divide.
Yeah.
There was North Tulsa. There's, you know, maybe East Tulsa and the rest of the community.
Yeah.
And those barriers are still very much there, but there are these chinks in the fence.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I left in 99. So, yeah. You know, this whole notion of people hanging out downtown was so not the case,
yeah,
right?
Right.
You had a few places, but I mean, I think the segregation, if we were to call it that, was definitely more prevalent back then. It's still the case now.
It's mostly this case now. But
yeah.
I think, especially in the arts community, you're starting to see these breakdowns, which were just as enforced a generation ago.
Yeah. And if one were to ask me, I'd say it's certainly in the arts where you find more progressive people. I mean, we have many examples of like what this looks like. But in our city, I've seen that artists are always willing to collaborate and to connect and just be around one another. And so
out of these soirees, as you call them, how did this idea come together? What would you say the vision of Black Wall Street Arts and the gallery is?
The impetus for, I'll say, the gallery was my learning about the Black Moon Collective, which was founded by a young lady named Elizabeth Henley. There are some 8 members of the collective, visual artists and a fashion designer. I had seen their work and I was really impressed. And at that point, I decided to just go around the different galleries trying to see about exhibition space for them. And I became friends with the gallery owners, but I didn't really make any headway with getting them on the walls. And so I decided, well, I'll just open up my own gallery and put them on the walls, right? Like, rather than going out. And it was a sort of curious thing because I think in a sense I was going out to seek validation for something that I already had a value for. Like, I knew that this was worth something. But when, you know, asking other people, like, you are in a way like asking for, you know, what they value. But no, I already knew the answer. I knew that this work was of value and I knew the potential that each artist had. So, yeah, there was no question I had to open up a gallery.
Well, and it's also, it gets into the commerce side of art, too, which,
yeah,
you know, I mean, is the clientele of that gallery going to be interested in this type of art?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's a matter, you know, I mean, that gets into all sorts of issues there.
Yeah.
So you open this gallery and you've started a series of exhibitions you call the Conciliations series.
Yes.
And not the Reconciliation series.
Correct.
What do you mean by conciliation series?
Well, okay, so by definition, reconciliation means restoring friendly relations. So we'd be presupposing the existence of friendly relations and then having to restore them. But I don't know, at least on the macro level, where Tulsa has had friendly relations between Black and white communities. I mean, we were just talking about even the current state of affairs and how there's still segregation. but I think we can create them, right? And so I think that moment of creation comes after that healing has taken place. Well, I think in order for us to heal as a city, you know, we need to deal with what conciliation is about. So we're talking mediation or arbitration, acknowledgement, apology, reparation, right? So at least I know conciliation suggests these things. And I think this would be an effort for us to create these friendly relations.
When I was thinking conciliation, I was thinking, oh, well, first you have to come together.
That's right. That's right. As the Beatles would say, right? And this is important to me because I find that people are eager to do so. I think in so many ways, they're just waiting for the spaces where they could go. And understand, too, that there will be difficult dialogues ahead. And so people do need to feel comfortable going into those spaces because, you know, we want voices to be amplified. You know, we want people to feel as if they are in a safe space to speak, to share, to vent, and what have you. I find that the Conciliation Series has opened up the door for a lot of people to be invited to share, right? And that's what our community needs. We need to be able to share. People need to be able to express themselves. And we need to deal with some sort of hard facts. You know, we have a shared history that isn't all so pleasant. And that history has to be acknowledged and discussed. And we need to rectify, right? Yeah. There's a lot there.
My guest today is Rico Wright. He's the director of the nonprofit Black Wall Street Gallery and Black Wall Street Arts. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You can go to the gallery and see the two latest artists in the Conciliation Series. It features one African-American, one white artist showing together. And I assume you're getting diverse groups to visit.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you get some people who are just there because they want to experience Black Wall Street. And you've got others who have come to support the artists. So there's a lot of diversity in that just by virtue of the series itself. And then you just have people who love the arts and they're excited that the arts is back in the Greenwood District. You know, there used to be a gallery where I am currently located. This was some decades ago, but I know probably 10 years ago, a young lady had a gallery there. And so people are excited that this is back. I have a lot of people who come from the Tulsa Arts District to the Greenwood District just to see the gallery.
Right.
And I send them over to Frio's as quickly as I can, you know, and Wanda J's too. Yeah.
Well, so you've had a couple of artists now since you opened in September.
Yes.
What's been the reaction from the community? Are you starting to have these conversations you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. The reaction has been terrific. People love what's happening. I mean, I recall the grand opening, we saw some 2,000 people come into the gallery that night. It was the first Friday, September 7th. And J.P. Morrison and Alexander Taman were the two featured artists. And their paintings were exceptional. I mean, people were coming in just blown away by their skill. And there was a lot of political and social commentary in Alexander's paintings, right? I mean, I recall one, there was a yellow backpack and there was a label on it that read Hope, but there was a bullet hole in the backpack. It's just like heart-wrenching to imagine a kid being shot, right? So it's just, you know, people seeing that type of, you know, art and examining it for what it is. I think it was impactful. And so month after month, they've been experiencing different pieces of artwork that speak to them.
Let me ask you, we talked about the difficulty in getting diverse groups together in Tulsa. You know, I have to say, one of the most hopeful things, I think, and I was hearing the hype of the Gathering Place as being this, and I said, well, you know, okay, we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
But I have to say, it seems to be a place where all Tulsans come together.
Yeah, and it is. It is.
You know, I was kind of being the cynical...
Yeah, fair enough.
Cynical, right? Journalist and say, okay, but really, it's given me a hopeful sense about, you know, because we've talked about this in the city for so long. And yet, it's pretty hard.
Yeah.
It is very hard.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think that GKFF wanted to bring about something where everybody was a part, right? And I think through Toni Moore's vision of having diversity in staff, and whoever's rolling out the content for that place for, like, concerts and stuff, is doing a really good job. I mean, I went there for the first time to see The Roots.
Yeah.
And I had seen The Roots before, many a time, actually, on the East Coast. But yeah, to see the roots in Tulsa and to see just a sea of diverse people. I mean, it was absolutely
It's
amazing.
Just not black and white. It's Hispanic. It's Asian.
That's
it's
right.
It's the whole community.
That's right. Natives. I mean, there was a great representation of everyone there. And everyone was so happy, you know, like everyone had a really good time.
So I'm going to ask you a question. Is art, with all of its baggage and all of its, you know, it can be very elitist at times. Is that the best way to get diverse communities together in Tulsa, and why?
I think so. No, I think what happens with art, I think when it becomes part of high culture is when it becomes more sophisticated and elitist. To my mind, for the most part, art is always something that grows out of something else that's more akin to oppression or, you know. And not always, but, you know, there's this notion of the starving artist, right? So this desire to create despite certain circumstances. But then, of course, that changes over time, you know.
If
makes you think about jazz, right?
If the artist is successful, he moves uptown. He moves from downtown to uptown. Right?
Yeah. It makes me wonder, like, how these transitions occur over time. But, you know, for a long time, jazz wasn't considered high class, right? I remember learning that W.E.B. Du Bois didn't even like jazz.
Right.
And he lived in Harlem. And, of course, you got Duke Ellington playing at the Cotton Club.
Sure.
So not everybody at that time when it first came to, you know, everyone's living room that it was considered high culture. But today you listen to jazz and it's like, oh, that's such a sophisticated thing, right? That genre is reserved for the sort of intellectual.
Well, and high art has adopted it.
Right.
And oftentimes the places where it was birthed has moved on to other things too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I think this just happens with art,
yeah,
you know.
True.
But I don't think it always starts there. It's always a question of how it ends up where it does.
So tell us, for people who've maybe not been out to Black Wall Street Gallery, what's showing now? What's going to be happening over the next couple of months?
Yeah, so Laura Voth, I think that's how you mm-hmm. pronounce her name, and Diamond Walker are on exhibition. And they are two vastly different artists. I mean, they work really well together. But you have in Laura someone who would take some espresso and put it on paper and make this incredible portrait of someone. And she also has an array of other monotones and such. But then you have with Diamond of an emphasis on the female figure, right? But then it's also colorful. But at the same time, you might have some mixed media there. She's incorporating paper along with whatever acrylic ink she's using. And then, of course, you have this sort of depth to it as well, right? And this is with respect to both of them. Really, really talented.
And that's on display till when?
Till the end of this month. We always roll out the next installment that first Friday.
Okay, there'll be one for December?
And so there will be, yeah, we always have another pair. So,
right.
I mean, we have 24 local artists in total that will be featured in the gallery during the Conciliation series. So this is a 12-month series, and we have it such that each pair collaborates on a piece. And so at the end of the Conciliation series, we'll have an additional month where we exhibit all of those.
The collaboration pieces. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that'll be great.
Yeah.
be great.
So,
well, Rico, we wish you great success.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Rico Wright is the director of the nonprofit Black Wall Street Arts and the Black Wall Street Gallery. You can learn more about their upcoming shows on their Facebook page. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Thanksgiving is a week away, and our commentator Connie Crontley shares a story about the holiday's origin.
I'd like to propose a Thanksgiving toast to Sarah Josepha Hale. She is the woman who invented Thanksgiving, but she did so much more. In 1822, when she was 34, her husband died. She wore black in perpetual mourning for almost 60 years, but she had 5 children to support. First, she tried being a milliner. Then she became a poet, writer, and editor of the most influential American magazine of the 19th century. Sarah Hale was one of America's first female novelists and one of the first to write a book about slavery. She wrote 50 books and poetry for adults and children, including Mary Had a Little Lamb. She was 49 when she was hired to edit Gottlieb Lady's book. She retired when she was 89. During her 40 years as editor, the magazine wielded incredible influence among middle-class American women in fashion, cooking, morality, and literature. Sarah Hale focused the magazine on American subjects and authors. She published Nathaniel Hawthorne, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Washington Irving, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Edgar Allan Poe, and women's education advocate Catherine Beecher. She never supported women's suffrage herself, but she was a pioneer in advocating for women's access to higher education and to the workforce, especially in teaching and medicine. In 1846, she began a 17-year crusade to establish one day for a national Thanksgiving holiday. She wrote to five presidents, all of whom ignored her. A day of Thanksgiving was a New England celebration, but she wanted the last Thursday in November to be a national feast honoring the women who nurture home and family. And she hoped the holiday would include two New England rural dishes, turkey and pumpkin pie. Finally, in 1863, 2 years into the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln agreed with her. But his proclamation was not celebrating women in home. Lincoln's proclamation was a national and official day of thanksgiving, praise, and supplication. Perhaps Thanksgiving Day might bring the North and the South together for at least one day. Lincoln's proclamation cited the blessings of fruitful fields, healthful skies, and the expectation of increase of freedom. It asked the Most High God for tender care of all those who have become widows, orphans, mourners, or sufferers in this lamentable civil strife. And it asked that the Almighty Hand heal the wounds of the nation and restore it to the full enjoyment of peace, harmony, tranquility, and union. His proclamation did not praise women in home specifically, but I do with this silly verse. Sarah had a little dream. It was fat and yummy. She named her dream Thanksgiving, a holiday for the tummy.
Connie Cronley is a local writer, essayist, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. By the way, you can hear Connie this evening if you have tickets for the Moth main stage tonight at 7:30 at the Canes Ballroom. She'll be one of the featured storytellers. Unfortunately, that event is already sold out. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.